Because they always get mentioned in the recordings, you see. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I made the coffee. It's good. I don't know. I just made coffee, but all right. So anyway, I'm going to do a little bit more review from last week than normal because I think about half of you weren't here last week. So just a little bit on Daniel. I did write a book on Daniel. There's the cover. Okay, so the theme of Daniel is God rules the nations. Do not fear. The message of Daniel, there's a twofold message. One is how to stay righteous in a world that is doing everything it possibly can to get you to compromise your convictions about righteous living. And the other one is God is in control. The idea is that, of course, we should live as if we believe that. Okay, another thing I said about Daniel in the Old Testament, Revelation in the New Testament, the theme is similar, the style is similar with apocalyptic language. The immediate audience of the book of Revelation is the Christian suffering extreme persecution under Domitian and others. And then the immediate audience of Daniel is Jews suffering extreme persecution under Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, I spent a fair amount of time explaining who that was and even pulling out 1 Maccabees last week, reading a little bit from 1 Maccabees to familiarize you with Antiochus, but I'm not going to do that now. I'll say a little bit more about that when we get to the relevant passages. All right, so both are written to people suffering great persecution. The message is, despite what you're seeing, God is in control. Be faithful, and God will take care of you in the end. Okay, so there's that thing. There's the actual coin, I believe, with Antiochus Epiphanes' figure on it. Okay, a few other things about Daniel I'm going to skip. What I spent quite a bit of time on last week is Daniel is sort of the final ground of battle over the question of whether the Bible is inspired by God. Now, most critics of the Bible don't know this, but the ones who really know what they're talking about realize that Daniel is the one place they have to go after because the prophecies are so ridiculously specific, as we're going to see. I think I use the example of it would be like I predicted that in the year 2736, El Salvador is going to be the most powerful country in the world, and a guy named Bill is going to be its president or something like that. If something like that actually happened, you'd say, God rules the nations, do not fear. And so the time of Antiochus Epiphanes is around 183 to 164 B.C. So the skeptics, those who do not believe in inspiration, say the book was written around 150 B.C., after the events, obviously, right? Because no one could prophesy the future from their perspective. So I spent quite a bit of time showing you why that is utter nonsense. I left off a few of their critical comments they would make because I'm going to cover them in the context when it comes into the passage. But let's just say that is a belief based on a presupposition, not a belief based on evidence. The presupposition is the Bible is not inspired by God, therefore we have to prove it. Okay, got it? All right, and then I did a little bit of the historical background. The main things to know here is it goes Babylon, and then Persia, Media, the dual empire of Persia, Media, and then the Greek empires under Alexander and his successors, and then Rome. Okay, so that's the chief thing. Relevant dates for Daniel are the year that he, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were taken to exile, as prophesied in Isaiah 39:2, about 150 years before it happened, 120 years rather. And then the date of the destruction of Jerusalem, all right? And then 70 years later is when the Jews began to come back, because Jeremiah prophesied 70 years. And then almost exactly 7 years after the destruction of Jerusalem, the temple was rededicated. Oh, it's not there. It's 516. It's in Zechariah and Haggai. Okay. This is the date for Alexander the Great beginning his conquests. this is the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes. The important years are 167 and 164 with the intense persecutions. We read some stuff, and I remember last week basically getting a look like, please stop reading that. It's from 2 Maccabees. I'm telling you, the stuff they went through is absolutely horrendous. It's unbelievable. Yeah, right. Remember? Yeah, people getting fried on the pan, and oh my goodness, their skin, you know, it's unbelievable. The persecutions. Temple desecrated, temple rededicated. This thing, which was prophesied in insane detail by Daniel, is now celebrated as Hanukkah. So the Jews celebrate that today. So it's history we don't know much about, but it's very relevant to Daniel. Okay, got it? And then the Battle of Actium prophesied in Daniel. Jesus gets born. The rest of the stuff you know. Okay, great. So there's the Babylonian Empire, the one that basically Nebuchadnezzar headed. There's the city of Babylon. Okay, here's the Persian Mede Empire, quite a bit larger, all the way from Egypt, Greece, and all the way into Central Asia. Okay, here's the Empire of Alexander the Great, even greater, the greatest empire in the world before Rome. Okay, so here's our outline. Chapters 1 and 3 through 6, these are the practical stories. So here, the theme of staying righteous despite what the world is trying to do to get you to become corrupt, to compromise your convictions, to back off on your convictions. And the other half of the book is chapters 2 and 7 through 12, and these are the visions of the future. And at first glance, the two parts of Daniel seem to have no connection. What are all these visions of the future have to do with these scenes of these guys basically standing strong for God? And the connection is this. If God can predict hundreds of years beforehand exactly what's going to happen, then that means that he rules the nations. That means God is in control of the big picture. So if God is in control of the big picture, then that means he's also in control of the little picture, which means he can get you a job if he wants you to have a job. He can get you a spouse if he wants you to have a spouse. Or he might allow you to continue having that cancer. These are things that we have to trust in God's hands. The righteousness of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego under the pressure they had is truly amazing. And how did they pull it off? Well, the answer is they believed that God rules the nations. Okay, got it? So that's the connection between the two parts, which at first glance seem to have nothing to do with each other. Okay? Any questions so far? All right. So then we did Daniel chapter 1. That's as far as we got. We just did one chapter because we spent over half the time last Saturday doing our introductory material. So in Daniel chapter 1, here the issue is, are you going to be righteous on the job, essentially? Will you allow the temptations of people to say, just a little compromise? We're not asking you to lie. We're just asking you to withhold information. All right? We're not asking you to do something illegal. We're just asking you to do something that, you know, maybe it has an appearance of evil, these kinds of things. And the point that we get from this is that we should use these as an opportunity to give glory to God. Don't ever, ever compromise. You tell them, take that job, and you know what you do with that job. Okay, got it? In fact, if they fire you, wouldn't that be awesome? Wouldn't it be awesome to get fired because you did the right thing? I mean, what would be better than that? Now, saying that to a father with a wife and children at home, I admit that that's a little bit of a stretch. Okay? But I'm serious about that, and I shared some examples where I've been in that kind of situation. And my job was threatened because I did the right thing. And you know what? In every case, it worked out, but even if it didn't. So the bottom line is they're offered this amazing opportunity to be servants of the king and to just serve in his palace. And basically they say, no, thank you. Not if we have to compromise what's right. Okay? And they did not have the support system we have, okay? Another theme that comes out here is, in chapter 1, verse 2, it says, the Lord delivered Jehoiakim into the hand of Babylon. In chapter 1, 6, verse 9, God caused the official to show favor to Daniel. In 1:17, God gave them knowledge and understanding. So every possible opportunity, Daniel and his friends give glory to God and they take no credit for themselves. This happens again and again and again. Great example for us. By the way, we're going to get to chapter 4 today, and Nebuchadnezzar does the exact opposite. And it doesn't work out too well for him. He takes credit for his awesomeness. Okay, so if you want to be prideful, probably stay away from Daniel because there's a lot of stuff on that. Okay, great. So now we're going to spend some time in Daniel chapter 3, which is basically how far we got. All right, so we may or may not finish through chapter 6 today. We'll see. But that's kind of where we're headed. Chapters 1 and then 3 through 6 and then 2 and 7 through 12. That's how it's going to work. All right, so the background here, this is a few years, whether it's 2 years or 5 or 6 years, we don't know. But it's probably just a few years after Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Daniel enter into the service of Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar is setting up a massive statue on the plains of Dura. It's a fairly large, flat area, not too far from Babylon. Probably the reason he set the statue up there is because there's no place in the city to have this party with tens of thousands of people to basically bow down to Nebuchadnezzar, essentially. All right. And the thing about this is it's worth noting because, remember, we're going out of order, Daniel 2 before Daniel 3. And Daniel 2 was when he had this vision of this huge statue. And then Daniel interprets the dream. And Nebuchadnezzar says, you know, God, there is a God in Israel, blah, blah, blah. Here it is 2-3 years later, and now he's making a statue dedicated to himself. So, you know, he had one of these religious experiences. You know, we all know people like that. Something happens. Oh, it's awesome church. Yeah, Jesus, blah, blah, blah. You know, like the rocky soil, you know, springs up and then it dies. So that's Daniel. By the way, eventually Daniel comes around. And Daniel's presented as somebody who essentially worshiped God by the time we're done. So that's sort of cool, actually. Anyway, so the theme here is, unlike chapter 1, where the theme is staying righteous under pressure at work, in Daniel 3 is staying righteous under pressure from religious contemporaries who are trying to get you to downplay the gospel and the commitment involved in the gospel, okay? So that's the practical application. All right, so let's start reading Daniel chapter 3. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide. That's like 90 feet high, probably up on a pedestal, all right? And set it up in the plains of Dura in the province of Babylon. He then summoned the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials to come to the dedication of the image he had set up. Now, this invitation is not like, y'all come. It's like, y'all come. Got it? Okay, it's not an optional thing. Anyways, so the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials assembled for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood before it. You have to imagine the scene. Tens of thousands of people in this open area in this huge statue. And everybody knows what this is about. It's an idol kind of representing Nebuchadnezzar himself. Got it? Then the herald loudly proclaimed, by the way, Daniel's not there. People ask, why is Daniel not there? And the answer is, I don't know. I assume he's probably off as an emissary to the king. I'm sure that that's something that he did often. I don't really know. I just figure he's just not in town for reasons we don't know. We know he's alive still, that's for sure. Anyway, then the herald loudly proclaimed, "Nations and peoples of every language, this is what you are commanded to do. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, and pipe, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace." Okay. "Therefore, as soon as they heard the sound of the horn, flute, zither, harp, lyre, and all kinds of musical, all the nations and peoples of every language fell down and worshipped the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up." A minor side point before I get into the lesson here. One of the claims that the book of Daniel was written around 150 BC is that it has Greek words in it. And back in the 6th century BC, there was relatively little interaction between Greece and Babylon. Well, that's debatable, since we know from Herodotus that there was an entire Greek army that served as mercenaries in Babylon. But the way I illustrated this is, what do you think they call a piano in China? They call it a piano. Why don't they have their own word for it? Because they didn't have pianos. The only Greek words in Daniel are for musical instruments. Okay? So if you're using musical instruments that, you know, see, so this is not evidence that there was a lot of Greek interaction with Babylon. It was evidence there was only a little bit, which is fits better to the 6th century B.C. than to the 2nd century B.C. Minor side point, okay? Now, here's the question. Would you have bowed down to that statue?
I'd like to think no.
Yeah, that's me commenting. I shouldn't have put that up there. Because I wanted you to think about it before I made any comments.
But you could do that.
Right, you could do that.
So pretend.
Right. So would you be tempted to do what I'm describing there? Okay, watch this, okay? All right, did I just sin? No? If bowing is sinful, then all Japanese people are really in big trouble. I mean, you know, they're just going to hell. All right? And remember what Paul said about meat sacrifice to the idol? What did he say about that? He said idols are nothing, right? And therefore, meat that's been sacrificed to nothing is just meat. And therefore, you can eat it. Now, if somebody tells you this was sacrificed to an idol, don't eat it, because then there's the whole thing, you know, of example and all that. All right, great. So I want to ask again, would you have bowed down to that idol? Now, you're right. You don't have to answer that question. All right. But I think it's something to think about. I believe that if Peter had thought before he went into that courtyard, he would have not have denied Jesus. If he thought, wow, I'm going to go into this courtyard, this is probably a place where, you know, man, what am I going to do if they say such and such? I almost guarantee you, if he'd thought through before he'd gone into that courtyard, he would not have blown it.
Right.
All right? So, you know, I don't think you're going to be ever asked to bow down to a statue or they will kill you. All right? But, you know, let's try to apply this. I'll try to give some practical examples. All right? So, I'll bow my head, but not my heart. That would have gone through my head, I guarantee you. Now, let's say they did bow down to the statue. Like, right there, blatantly, bow down to this idol. Would they go to hell for having done that?
Well, I mean, don't we do that all the time ourselves?
Thank you, Nora. Thank you for pointing out that for us to condemn them under the circumstances would be quite hypocritical, don't you think? Mm-hmm. But, you know, the question is not whether they go to hell for doing it. What's at stake here is the honor of God. Mm-hmm. And really, that's what the book of Daniel is about. The question is, when you're in this situation, bottom line, are you going to give glory to God or not? So as Christians, we should think of something like this not as a problem, but as an opportunity. What a great opportunity. Yeah.
Once I was invited to a wedding, and I went to the wedding, and then this is a Catholic. And then the lady near was standing by me. She says, well, you're not going to kneel?
You know,
I said, no. And then she says, why not? I said, because I don't believe what you're doing. And so then she wanted to know more, but, you know, it was a wedding. I was not going like that. But I didn't nail, and I just stayed there because I had to go to this wedding, but I didn't, like, do everything they do.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I might have shared this last week, but one time my friend Joe, we were just talking, and he was very religious. He's one of the more sincere religious people that I've been around. He was very sincere. And we're just talking. I just mentioned, you know, what I understood in the role of baptism. And he says, no, wait a minute. Do you think I'm going to hell? And I said, well, I'm just telling you what I believe the Bible says, you know. That's what all of us would do, right? And he says, no. He says, I want to know, do you think I'm going to hell? I said, well, you know. And he said it for the third time, and I said, yeah, I think you're going to hell. I mean, seriously. You know, people say, you know, your group is just a cult. You say, well, you know, it's not a cult, but I'll tell you right now, there's a reason people say that. Because we put Jesus' commands about discipleship into practice. Okay, I can remember times I'd be walking through campus and there'd be somebody I know from work and I'd kind of do this, you know. Have you ever done something like that?
Yes.
All right. Yeah. Now, you have to understand remember, we have to think about context and who's it written to. And so the two principal audiences we should have in mind are, number one, the Christians who not under Domitian, but under Diocletian and Galerius. This is actually 3rd and 4th century. I don't even know this, but the greatest persecutions were not in the 1st, 2nd century or the 2nd century. They were in the 3rd and 4th century. And basically, they were commanded to come in to the town hall, essentially, and just offer just a little sacrifice thing and say a little thing and, you know, eat a little piece of meat that had been sacrificed to an idol. And the question is, would you have done that or not? Because if you didn't, you could be thrown in prison or you'd almost certainly lose your job. So the question is, would you have done that or not? Because it's just words, you know. And by the way, just, you know, a significant number of the Christians did do that. And more commonly, what they would do is they would send their servant to do it for them. All right? Or think about the Jews during the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. And if you want to read about that, again, read 1st and 2nd Maccabees. And you'll see that most of the Jews said, a little Hellenization in our worship, that's not such a bad thing. Let's just all get along. Okay? So, again, we should think about the situation in Daniel 1 and the situation in Daniel 3 not as a problem. No. As an opportunity. And do you see it that way? Do you see it that way? I shared last week about basically because of sharing my faith, I essentially, you know, got fired. Not quite. They kind of gave me one more year before we fire you. And, you know, to me, that was actually a pretty awesome thing. And then later on, the guy tried to do that. He got fired instead and I got tenure. But you know what? Even if it hadn't gone that way, the point is not the happy ending, right? That is not the point. The point is not the happy ending. The point is, what are you going to do? Because when you do it, you don't know what the outcome will be, right? You don't know. All right, so let's read on. At this time, some astrologers came forward and denounced the Jews. So imagine, this is a beautiful scene. It's a beautiful scene. Just like, you know, not kneeling at that service, probably if people are looking over at you and, you know, maybe you should have, maybe you shouldn't, but I just like the point that you're standing up for something. You're willing to be different. I like that. So anyway, so thousands and thousands are bowing down and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are standing proud for God. Teenagers. You know, they don't have a discipler. They don't have a church to answer to. Yeah, and the other people, they're doing this. They're like, because they don't care about the stupid idol. Come on, they're not really worshiping. Come on, you know. So they're like, oh, see those guys? Now, Nebuchadnezzar is up on the stage, and he's not going to be too happy. If you're going to stand up for God, somebody's going to be mad at you. They want to cut you down. You know why? Because you make them look bad. Your commitment to God makes the fact that they're just, Sunday morning Christians, it makes it look bad. And they want all Christianity to be taken down to some low level, right? That's what they want. Okay? And I'm afraid that we tend to soft pedal. But Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did not do that. I'm so proud of them. At this time, some astrologers came forward and denounced the Jews. They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, "May the king live forever, you awesome person that we love so much, who we don't really actually love, but that's what we're saying because, you know, you pay our salary. All right. Your majesty has issued a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all other instruments must fall down and worship the image of gold, and that whoever does not fall down and worship will be thrown into a blazing furnace. But there are some Jews, some Christians from the Bakersfield Church of Christ, those Church of Christers. All right. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego who pay no attention to you. In fact, I believe Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego honored the king as much as these other people did, honestly. Anyway, they neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you set up. Now, that's true. Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king. And Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold that I've set up? Now, when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, and pipe, and all kinds of music, if you're ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand?" All right, this is quite a scene. So in front of probably tens of thousands, they are dragged up onto the stage. And so these teenagers looking face to face to the most powerful man in the world, he says, "Who do you think you are?" You know? And he said, "What God can save you?" Because if you look at the facts are that his God was more powerful than their God. From the ancients' way of thinking about it, his God was obviously more powerful than their God. Because he had conquered their people, and the items from their treasury, from the temple rather, were sitting in his treasury. So from every outward perspective, it appears to be a really bad idea. It's time to kind of change your mind and go ahead and compromise your religious convictions. I really love their answer. This is classic. These three teenagers, torn away from everything they know, from their culture, from their religion, from their friends, any religious support at all, say to the most powerful man in the world, "King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter." Imagine the gall. Well, I don't need to defend ourselves before you. You're not the authority here. Do you think Nebuchadnezzar is going to appreciate hearing that?
No.
You have no authority over us. Right? Say that to your boss. Try that. Okay. And by the way, I think that, you know, in most cases, we should not, you know, we should be professional. So if the rule is you are not allowed to share faith at work, then you probably shouldn't share your faith at work, okay? But nevertheless, anyway, says, if we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. Now, did they expect to be saved from the flames?
Yes.
I don't think so. I mean, I can't prove they didn't expect to be saved from the flames, but there's no evidence at all. First of all, no precedent. No precedent. Okay. And no evidence at all that God had told them, hey, if you stand up for me, literally, stand up for me, it's going to work out okay. Now, maybe, I mean, but what they say is, but even if he does not, but even if he does not. And, you know, like we said, when are we tempted to think that God is not in control?
Oh, when things go...
Yeah, things don't go the right way. Well, duh. That's like the wife that says to her husband, you know, I'll submit to you when I want to, but when I don't agree with you, then I won't. You know, okay. In other words, not at all, you know. All right. I don't know why I use that example. I shouldn't use that example. But it just came out of my mouth. Whatever the equivalent thing would be. All right. And so I think it's really, really important to notice they said, but even if he does not. I believe that God will give me a godly spouse. But even if he does not, I'm not going to compromise. I'm not going to start dating around with supposedly Christian people who probably are not. You know? I believe that if I demand for my boss to give me Sunday off or I'm going to be fired, I believe he will give me Sunday off. But even if he does not. You know what I'm saying? And so the temptation is, when it doesn't, in quotes, work out, that we doubt that God's in control. But see, either you believe that he's in control or you don't. And if it doesn't work out and that makes you think he's not in control, what's that mean? That you don't believe he's in control at all. Not even a little bit. That's why I use that example. You know, maybe I get in trouble for that, but, you know, if you say, I will unless I disagree, what are you really saying? You're saying, I won't. If you say, I really, really believe he's in control when everything works out for me, that means you don't believe it even at all, not even a little bit. Okay? And really, that kind of goes with that Malachi sermon a couple weeks ago, you know, being faithful to God rather than having faith in God. But even if he does not. So maybe we could do some sharing. Anybody want to share some situations where you've been put in a kind of a touchy situation, kind of on a religious issue, and maybe either where you went for it, or where maybe you kind of didn't. I've already shared examples for me where, you know, I hid my Bible and that kind of stuff. Anybody want to share? Yeah.
I think when I was studying the Bible, I was baptized before, so I was like accepting Jesus in my heart kind of thing with my family. And then I moved to San Diego and started studying the Bible, and because I never had read the Bible before. So when I started studying, I realized I had learned the truth. And when I talked to my parents about getting baptized, they hear you baptized. And then it was like this huge controversy of like, you don't need, like, baptism is not essential salvation.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't believe in that. And it was hard because I respect my parents a lot and I value what they have to say, but also, like, I was like, I studied the scriptures, like, I feel like this is true, so I'm going to do it. And it took them a while. It caused turmoil in my house just a little bit, but then didn't stop me from like making the decision to send your life to Jesus. So I mean, I still kind of conflict still, but yeah, so that's just one of the things.
Mm-hmm. Right. My experience is, and we'll take some more sharing. My experience is when people, basically younger people, not stand up to their parents like, you terrible people, but hey, this is what I'm going to do. My experience is most of the time the parents come around eventually. But I've known in some cases where they just flat out never, ever did. You know, parents, they refused to come to their wedding and stuff like that. Yeah. Leo, were you going to share?
Yeah, I know last week I shared about the job thing, but you just reminded me when I was in campus ministry in Santa Barbara, I was obviously going to everything probably 6 days a week. We
had probably, yeah.
And so I didn't see my parents for about the first 4 months after I got baptized. So yeah, that's probably bad.
Yeah, probably you would do it different now, yeah.
But my mom called me, and she said, basically at the end of the conversation, it's either church or me. You know, choose.
That's tough.
So I got to the point where it's like, my mom said, you know, cutting you off if you go with the church or you choose me.
Wow.
And it was that moment where I was praying, and I was silent for a moment, and I said, I have to choose church. I was just so scared to say that, but
right.
I wanted to stand up because I believed if I stood up that eventually she'll come around. Years later, she and my stepdad studied the Bible and got baptized in our church.
So. And surely they never would have if you hadn't done that, yeah.
I think so.
Wow.
But that was really hard.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Mine's kind of more of an internal struggle with, I guess, the legality of some of the situations. And Chris might even be able to relate to this a little bit, but when I was in the service, I held a top secret security clearance. And when you hold a security clearance of that level, the smallest thing that goes wrong in your life can pretty much have that revoked from you. And so there was a period where my orders didn't go through correctly, so I ended up not getting paid for like a period of 2 to 3 months. And I was really stressing out about it because it's like I wanted to, you know, make sure I was able to pay my bills. But if I defaulted on any of my loans, like I could potentially lose my job. And so I was really stressing out about it. And I was like, well, I got to talk to somebody because otherwise this is just going to get out of hand. And so ultimately I made the commitment before God I was going to go and talk to my supervisor about it. And his answer was actually pretty prolific for me. He was like, why don't you just call up the company and see if they'll give you a waiver for a month or two until your orders come through. And I was like, why didn't I think of that?
Yeah.
So I called them up, and sure enough, they waived it for the 2 months that it took me to get pay started again, and everything was fine. They're like, no problem, just pay when you can.
Yeah.
But it was like the decision that I had was in my mind, there was no way out, because I'm like, if I do this, I'm in trouble. Mm-hmm. So if like, I tell them I can't pay my bills, like I'm going to lose everything. But at the same time, it's like if I do nothing, it's going to be even worse. So coming in, bringing it into the light actually saved me.
Yep, yep. It's funny what the things we fear that, yeah. And how many, all of you have heard examples, you've been for a while, for somebody who says, you know, I can't make it a midweek because I have to at work. And you ask, well, did you ask for the day off? No. You know? Okay, another example.
But I noticed that the doctor, some of the phone calls will make him really nervous. You can tell. And whoever answers, they will say, oh, he's not here.
They would lie.
Yeah, they were lying for him. So one day, it was a Saturday, and this phone rang. And I guess he knew. And he says, Anna John, answer the phone and tell them I'm not here yet. And so I answered the phone. I said, he's here, but he's not able to make it to you. He will get in touch with you later. And then when I hang up, he was very
angry. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Dr. Rosan, I'm not going to lie to you, and I'm not going to lie for you. You are here. So I took the message,
yeah.
And I give him the paper.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then later on, he will, whenever somebody lies, he will say, call Maria.
Yeah.
See, so sometimes, and I didn't, sometimes I didn't want to compromise. I said, Dr. Brunson, I don't know.
Right.
I don't know anything. I wasn't here. But because it was like constantly hiding things. I had to quit. I said, I'm leaving.
Yeah.
It's too much.
Exactly.
It's stress too.
Right. And the thing is, if you do the right thing, it's good no matter what, because a lot of us have examples where you basically stood up for God and it worked out great. And then we have some examples where we stood up to God and it worked out really bad. But you've got to realize one of the messages of Daniel is, but even if he does not. All right. But even if he does not, because I believe that getting fired for Jesus is at least as good. It's at least as good as standing up and then you get the promotion instead. All right, either way. But the question really is, do you believe that God's in control? That's what it comes down to. Do you actually believe he's in control or not? Because, in a situation like this, if I ask, do you believe God's in control? Everybody raises their hand.
Right.
But then you have a situation like this, fiery furnace, and then we find out who really does. Okay, and again, it's not necessarily you go to hell if you mess up in this way. That's really not what this is about. What it's about is, come on. Are you going to give glory to God? Anyway, then Nebuchadnezzar was furious with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and his attitude towards them changed. In what way? I mean, he was already really mad at them. All right, it's like basically no more chances. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times hotter than usual. And the critics who try to find something to prove that Daniel's bogus is, well, you can't make it 7 times hotter. He didn't say they literally made it 7 times hotter. He said make it 7 times hotter. That's something you'd say when you're angry. That makes perfect sense. As if this disproves the accurate. That's ridiculous. But anyway, people do that kind of stuff with Daniel. And commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, throw them into the blazing furnace. So these men, wearing their robes, trousers, turbans, and other clothes, were bound and thrown into the blazing furnace. The king's command was so urgent, and the furnace was so hot, that the flames of the fire killed the soldiers who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar, and by the way, I believe it was not too late. I believe while they were being dragged to the furnace, they could have said, wait, never mind. I almost guarantee you that Nebuchadnezzar said, okay, great, perfect, yeah. Because that's going to prove to everybody that you could be intimidated by this king. And what were they thinking? Put yourself in the mind of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego as they're being dragged to this furnace.
We're going to get roasted.
Yeah. That's going to be, it's going to hurt our family. I mean, we thought God raised us up to this position so he could use us. No, he raised us up to this position only we could be burned in the furnace. But they did not raise their hand. They allowed themselves to be thrown into the furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leaped to his feet in amazement and asked his advisors, weren't there 3 men that we tied up and threw into the fire? And they replied, certainly, your majesty. That's what you say to them. Yes, your majesty. It is as you say. Yes. He said, look, I see 4 men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed, and the 4th looks like a son of the gods. And I'll tell you right now, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they were fired up at this point.
Literally.
Okay. Yeah. Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out, come here. People speculate who this 4th person was. Was it Jesus? Maybe. I kind of doubt it. An angel? I don't know. It's just the 4th person. Something pretty awesome, though, I'm sure. All right, so Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire, and the satraps, prefects, governors, and royal advisors crowded around them. It was awesome. Verse 28, then Nebuchadnezzar said, praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. All right, and the king promoted them in the province. Now, to me, the fact that this story has a, in quotes, happy ending is not particularly relevant to the application of this chapter. Now, again, I can imagine the Jews, like we read in 2 Maccabees, who are standing before Antiochus, and he's saying, you know, just, you know, worship, you know, whatever, do the Greek thing and all that, and all this kind of stuff. And I imagine them thinking about Daniel chapter 3 and saying, no, it's worth it. You know, God can save us, but even if he does not. All right. And but again, the application is for us. Now, we're going to take a short break and then we'll do Daniel 4 and 5. We may or may not get to Daniel 6 today. So if you came here a little bit late, get yourself a muffin. We're going to take about a 5-minute break.
More people this week.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I knew there'd be more. 45 minutes, yeah.